The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the July 25th, 2014 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Congress, Obama, clash over the border crisis. What happened? With outrage building over the humanitarian crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border, Republican lawmakers this week vowed to block President Obama's request for $3.7 billion in emergency funding and proposed new legislation authorizing the rapid deportation of at least 57,000 undocumented children back to Central America. The president's proposed emergency funding would be used mostly to house, feed, and hold hearings for unaccompanied children, most from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, who have been caught illegally entering the country from Mexico since October. But Senator Ted Cruz and House Republicans vowed to oppose Obama's spending requests unless the administration stopped granting amnesty to the migrants. New Justice Department figures showed that only 3,525 illegal juveniles were deported last year. Tens of thousands of others have been dumped at bus stations or released to their families pending hearings that often do not occur. Republican lawmakers proposed amending the 2008 Wilberforce Act, which requires the government to give a full asylum hearing to Central American children who are fleeing traffickers. The new amendment would remove the asylum requirement and allow authorities to deport them within a week of being detained. "We want to swiftly and humanely return them to their homes," said House Committee on Homeland Security Chairman Michael McCaul. But Senate Judiciary Chairman Patrick Leahy said he and other Democrats would fight tooth and nail to keep the 2008 law unchanged. "When you have an 8- or 9-year-old girl who's being raped by gangs," said Leahy, "I'm not sure Americans really feel we should immediately send them back." What the editorial said: "Obama brought this crisis upon himself," said the New York Post, "by issuing an executive order in 2012 granting a quasi-legal status to minors who arrived here illegally before 2007, the president invited thousands of children to team up with Central American coyotes and try their luck at sneaking into the country. Most of the kids were caught by Border Patrol," said the Los Angeles Times, "but insufficient space in detention centers led young detainees to be released into the custody of their families, allowing them to disappear into America's shadows. Thus, the rumors of permisos spread." "This isn't an immigration problem," said the New York Times. "It's a refugee crisis. Drug gangs now rule the streets in Central American countries, killing or sexually abusing kids who refuse to join their criminal enterprises. Honduras is now the murder capital of the world. In El Salvador, murders of kids under 17 have soared 77% in a year. Republicans who would gut the 2008 anti-trafficking law, a bipartisan bill that was signed by George W. Bush, are showing appalling blindness to humanitarian tragedy." What the columnist said: "It's true the 2008 law created a powerful incentive for Central American refugees to flee to the U.S., said E.J. Dion in the Washington Post. "But it's also true that the law was passed in the spirit of protecting innocent children from the horrors of war and gang violence. Do we really want to repeal that commitment the moment it becomes inconvenient? Repatriate them? How stone-hearted, you say," says Charles Krauthammer, also in the Washington Post. "But there are tens of millions of people suffering all over the world, and we cannot expect America to open its doors to every one of them. By what moral logic should there be a Central American exception? Put bluntly, the United States or any other country couldn't exist without borders, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. Marking a line around a country is a fundamental aspect of national sovereignty, and it isn't chauvinistic, jingoistic, or yahooistic to recognize that fact. Do not expect a resolution of this crisis anytime soon, said Ruben Navarrete in CNN.com. A wave of deportations will not discourage people who face horrendous violence and poverty in their home countries. Indeed, sources tell me that there are tens or even hundreds of thousands of Central American women and children in northern Mexico right now, waiting for their chance to cross over. No matter what the politicians in Washington say and do, people will keep coming. Our second main story, Israel's bloody showdown with Hamas. What happened? Israel was threatening to escalate its offensive against Hamas this week after the Gaza-based militant group rejected a proposed Egyptian ceasefire and launched a barrage of missiles that were answered by Israeli airstrikes. The unraveling of the Egyptian truce proposal offered little hope for a diplomatic solution to the two-week-old conflict, which has left more than 200 Palestinians dead, including at least 34 children and one Israeli civilian. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu authorized the Israeli Defense Forces to use full force against Hamas and declared the militants would pay the price for their decision to continue fighting. Hamas said it rejected the ceasefire, which was accepted by Israel, because it met none of its demands, such as the release of hundreds of Palestinians jailed in recent Israeli military sweeps in the West Bank. Israel's Iron Dome system intercepted scores of rockets Hamas continued to fire into Israel, and the IDF pounded dozens of suspected Hamas command centers and rocket launching sites. The Israelis warned 100,000 residents in northern Gaza to evacuate their homes via leaflet drops, text messages, and automated phone calls. A senior Israeli official told the New York Times that the likelihood of a ground invasion to eliminate the militants' rockets was now very high. To fight terrorism, he said, you must be present, boots on the ground. What the editorial said, Hamas is not responsible for this crisis, said the Daily Star. Netanyahu knew from day one that the incident that sparked this conflict, last month's kidnapping and murder of three Israeli teens in the West Bank, was not carried out by Hamas, but by a rogue Islamist affiliate. But he went ahead and launched airstrikes on Gaza anyway, provoking Hamas to respond with rockets. Now hundreds of Palestinians are dead, and unless the international community steps in, innocent blood will continue to flow. That's because Hamas is using human shields, said the Washington Post. Israel tries to avoid civilian casualties by giving advanced warning of airstrikes. But Hamas tells Gazans to stay in their homes, even as its commanders have burrowed into underground bunkers. The militant group calculates that Western governments will be so sickened by the slaughter that they will pressure Israel to grant Hamas's demands. The international community must not surrender to Hamas's despicable tactics, but demand it accept Egypt's ceasefire. What the columnist said, this futile conflict has exposed the utter nihilism of Hamas, said Jeffrey Goldberg in TheAtlantic.com. After Israel's withdrawal from Gaza in 2005, the Islamists could have begun building the nucleus of a state, rather than turn the territory into one big rocket factory. But what Hamas wants is not a state in a part of Palestine. It wants the destruction of Israel. It will not achieve the latter, and it is actively thwarting the former. In fact, hopes for an independent Palestinian state are dead for the foreseeable future, said David Horovitz in The Times of Israel. Netanyahu last week cited the rocket attacks from Gaza as the reason he could never, ever countenance a fully sovereign Palestinian state in the West Bank, since the high ground there could also be used for rocket attacks. No return of West Bank land to Palestinian control means no two-state solution and no possibility of peace. This is an earthquake, said Peter Beinart in Haaretz. It's long been obvious that Netanyahu did not believe in the possibility of peace, but he's now made it official. That leaves Israel with the need to maintain permanent, undemocratic dominion over millions of Palestinians. Both sides are hardening, said Roger Cohen in the New York Times. The skewed death toll, more than 3,800 Palestinians have been killed since 2005, compared with fewer than 200 Israelis, hurts Israel in the eyes of the world. Yet the Israelis are growing increasingly bitter. Israel's drift toward a culture of hatred toward Arabs will continue, while Palestinians are relentless in their own propaganda, fostering hatred of Jews among their people. Shed a tear, shed a thousand. It makes no difference. Our controversy of the week: immigration reform. The political calculation changes. Until now, immigration reform has been a no-lose proposition for President Obama and the Democrats, said Karen Timolte in the Washington Post. If the Democrats could push comprehensive reform through a reluctant Congress, they could take credit. If Republicans blocked it, the GOP would further alienate crucial Hispanic and moderate voters. But the massive influx of young migrants from Central America, at least 57,000 since October, is scrambling the politics of immigration, leaving the country deeply divided about who's at fault and what should be done. The surge in young refugees to the Texas border reflects a number of choices American politicians have made, said Mark Ambinder in TheWeek.com. There's no doubt that Obama's more welcoming immigration policies, especially his 2012 decision to stop deporting undocumented immigrants brought here as children, led many young Central Americans to risk the dangerous trip to the U.S. border. With midterm elections looming, both parties are now leery of appearing too pro-immigrant, a political calculation that will effectively close the casket on immigration reform until after 2016. That's entirely Obama's fault, said Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. Even with the current crisis, the GOP leadership supports a pathway to citizenship for millions of immigrants already in the U.S., but only after we secure the border. The way to do that is to complete the fence at the Mexican frontier, a project estimated in 2009 to cost $6.6 billion. House Republicans have been proven to be right, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. They blocked last year's Senate immigration bill on the grounds that Obama couldn't be trusted to enforce its border security provisions. Now we see the result of Obama's refusal to tighten border security: a new flood of Central American children who were convinced that all they had to do was attain residency in the U.S. was to make it across the border. There can be no further talk of amnesty until the borders are truly closed and the rule of law is restored. It's simply not true that the border isn't secure, said Sally Kahn in TheDailyBeast.com. The 57,000 young migrants detained while trying to sneak over the border were, in fact, caught after fleeing rampant gang violence and sexual abuse in Central America. What do Republicans want? Armed drones firing on these kids? Rather than throw open the borders, said Simon Malloy in Salon.com, Obama has aggressively deported hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants in recent years in the hopes that the Republicans would come around and embrace real reform. But they didn't. While Washington is incapacitated by the politics of immigration reform, said Shannon O'Neill in foreignpolicy.com, state and local governments are leading the way. In 2013 alone, 45 states passed a total of more than 400 measures dealing with the treatment of undocumented immigrants. A few, like Arizona's notorious law authorizing cops to demand people's papers, have made life miserable for immigrants, with disastrous repercussions for the state's economy. But the majority were designed to help immigrants learn English, open bank accounts, get access to health care and ID cards, and attend college. Why? Because the nation's states and cities have learned through experience that when immigrants are integrated into the community, they create jobs, boost tax revenues, and make the community safer. Someday, Congress may figure that out too. Well, it was a good week for premonitions. After an English court ruled that a restaurant owner must split his $1.7 million lottery jackpot with a waiter who pestered him into buying a ticket because he'd had a dream he'd win. It was a good week for picking heads after an election for a New Mexico county judgeship was decided by a coin toss when the two candidates each received exactly 2,879 votes. Democrat Kenneth Howard Jr. made the lucky call. Heads. It was a good week for the spirit of sharing after the Berkeley, California City Council passed an ordinance requiring medical marijuana dispensaries to give at least 2% of their pot free to very low-income individuals making less than $32,000 a year. It was a bad week for national stereotypes after a new study revealed that 26,000 British youngsters aged between 5 and 9 are admitted to the hospital every year because of rotting teeth. It all relates to the consumption of sugary, fizzy drinks, said a dentist. It was a bad week for drafting the dead after a computer bug caused the U.S. Selective Service System to send more than 14,000 conscription letters to men born in the 1800s. I was dumbfounded, said Chuck Huey, 73, of Pennsylvania, after receiving a letter demanding that his late grandfather register for the draft or face imprisonment. It was a bad week for dead stops after a malfunctioning door caused a corpse to fall from the back of a coroner's van onto a busy Pennsylvania road, making traffic come to a standstill. I thought someone was playing a prank, said one driver. I don't know if I should laugh or cry. On the briefing page, the other Iraq. Iraq's Kurds have remained largely insulated from the chaos in the rest of the country. Now they're seeking independence. Why are the Kurds breaking away? Ever since the U.S. invasion toppled Saddam Hussein, they've been running Iraqi Kurdistan as a semi-autonomous region, and now see the country's disintegration as an opportunity. Kurdistan is largely peaceful, safe, and thanks to carefully invested oil wealth, increasingly prosperous. The capital, Erbil, boasts luxury apartment blocks, five-star hotels, and gleaming new shopping malls. The recent declaration of a caliphate by a military group of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, gives the Kurds, a non-Arabic, mostly Sunni Muslim people with their own language and culture, a chance to achieve their long-standing goal of an independent nation. The president of Iraqi Kurdistan, Masoud Barzani, recently asked the region's parliament to prepare for a referendum on breaking away. Iraq is effectively partitioned now, he said. Are we supposed to stay in this tragic situation? Have the Kurds always been so successful? No, in fact, Kurdish history has primarily been defined by persecution. For centuries, Kurds lived a largely nomadic existence in the Mesopotamian plains and highlands of Turkey and Iran. When the Ottoman Empire was dismantled at the end of World War I, a victorious Britain and France promised the Kurds an independent homeland, but in the face of Turkish opposition, failed to keep their word. Instead, the Kurds, who today number around 30 million, were split between different nations. In Iraq, as in many other countries where they formed minorities, Kurds faced serious oppression. When the Arab Nationalist Ba'ath Party took power in 1968, Kurdish books were pulled from libraries and burned, and teachers were banned from using Kurdish language, a close relative of Persian. The repression only grew worse when dictator Saddam Hussein took over in 1979. What did Saddam do? He committed genocide. In retaliation for Kurdish support for Iran in the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, his Air Force dropped poison gas on Kurdish towns and villages. Anyone who survived was rounded up and taken to prison camps, where men and boys deemed old enough to hold a gun would be summarily executed. When the campaign ended in 1989, 90% of Kurdish villages had been wiped off the map, and up to 100,000 people had been slaughtered. The Kurds rebelled again after the Gulf War of 1990-91, but were once more crushed by Iraqi forces, and only avoided annihilation because the West imposed a no-fly zone over their territory in 1991. That protection allowed the Kurds to establish a semi-autonomous region with its own parliament, which is now home to 6.5 million people. Did they welcome Saddam's fall? In 2003, American troops were greeted in Iraqi Kurdistan as liberators. "I felt like a soldier driving through France at the end of World War II," said Army Lieutenant Colonel Harry Shute. "Cheering people lined the highway in every village we passed." In national elections in 2005, the Kurds became the second largest parliamentary group and negotiated further autonomy from Baghdad. As Iraq was torn apart by fighting between Arab Shiites and Sunnis, foreign energy companies invested in the relatively peaceful Kurdish region, which sits on an estimated 45 billion barrels of oil, the world's sixth largest reserve. Iraq's energy sector is supposed to be controlled by Baghdad, but late last year, the Kurds finished building their own pipeline to Turkey and started exporting 120,000 barrels a day. Iraq's Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki responded by cutting off the region's share of the national budget. But the Kurds refused to halt their exports. "We want to have control of our economic destiny," said Ashti Haurami, Iraqi Kurdistan's Minister of Natural Resources. How has the rise of ISIS affected the Kurds? It has deepened the tensions with Maliki and the Baghdad government. When Iraq's Shiite-dominated army responded to the ISIS offensive by retreating in panic and abandoning posts along the disputed border between Kurdish and Arab Iraq, the Peshmerga, the Kurds' fierce armed forces, rushed forward. They grabbed the city of Kirkuk, which Kurds consider their ancestral capital, as well as several government oil refineries. Maliki accused the Kurds of collaborating with ISIS to break apart Iraq, a charge the Kurds deny. "We simply filled the security vacuum," a Peshmerga fighter told The Economist. Is independence realistic? The U.S. has asked the Kurds not to break away, but there is little to keep the Kurds within Iraq. While Turkey once regarded the idea of an independent Iraqi Kurdistan as a threat, thinking it would encourage its own Kurdish population to demand independence, Ankara is now happy to use the Kurds as a buffer against the chaos in Iraq. They want a stable and commercially viable state on their southern border, said David Phillips, an Iraq expert at Columbia University. So despite the opposition in Washington and Baghdad, Kurdish independence seems inevitable. In the very near future, said Adnan Mufti, a senior official of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, the Kurdish state will become a reality. Take a look now at a few of the best columns. The first comes from the U.S. from Ronald Brownstein at the National Journal. President of only half the country. America's last three presidents have something in common, said Ronald Brownstein. By this point in their second terms, Presidents Obama, George W. Bush, and Clinton all faced the stark reality that they were functioning as the president of only half of America. By 1998, Republicans were so adamant in their opposition to Clinton that they were moving inexorably toward impeachment. 6 years later, Bush faced furious opposition from Democrats over the Iraq War, and his plan to privatize Social Security. In year six of his presidency, Obama is openly fed up with the relentless GOP opposition and the loathing of red state voters. Future presidents may be doomed to the same fate. Democratic presidents are now elected by younger, racially diverse, more secular, and heavily urbanized voters, whereas Republicans get their support from older, more religious, non-urban white people. Satisfying one coalition without alienating the other has become daunting. Ideologues condemn any attempt to compromise as capitulation. That's a formula for partisan warfare, perpetual gridlock, and more presidents who can't muster the support of more than half of America. Here's a column from Germany, from Hans Racher at Der Standard. How far for gender neutrality? A storm is raging over Austria's national anthem, said Hans Racher. During an outbreak of linguistic feminism in 2012, the words, "You are home to great sons," were changed to "home to great daughters and sons," which is more female-friendly, but doesn't scan properly. Last month, folk singer Andreas Gabalier, he of the skin-tight Lederhosen, sang the original version at a performance, saying he learned the old words as a child and couldn't change now. And he invoked a subsequent outpouring of support on the internet as evidence that the rest of Austria was of like mind. Several women, though, begged to differ. Former women's minister Maria Rauch-Kalat snapped that because Gabalier was no longer in diapers, he had presumably learned to control his sphincter since childhood and could control his tongue as well. Education Minister Gabriel Heinisch-Husk criticized Gabalier and received a torrent of nasty online abuse. Does that mean that most Austrians agree with the singer? Not necessarily. The internet is hardly representative. One sees only the mob and not the non-disturbed. Still, the new lyric does sound stupid. In fact, anthems in general are maudlin and old-fashioned. Let's just all agree that they should never be sung. Here's a third column from Pakistan. It's an editorial from the Express Tribune titled, "Confronting the Shame of Dowry Violence." It is a national embarrassment that Pakistani women have no recourse when their husbands beat them up while demanding dowry money, said the Express Tribune. India outlawed the antiquated and patriarchal practice of bringing assets from a bride's family to a groom's decades ago. But in Pakistan, many women still come to marriage with a significant dowry they are supposed to control, only to be beaten or even killed by husbands who want to spend it. In Hirapur last week, a woman filed a complaint after her husband fractured her skull while demanding her dowry. She waited a year and a half to bring the complaint, enduring beating after beating and attempting to leave her husband only to be ordered back to him by tribal elders. Her delay is understandable, since the law is not with her. Pakistan not only has no law banning dowry, it also has no law banning domestic violence. A woman's dignity and self-respect are shamelessly trampled upon across the length and breadth of the country, not least in our corridors of power. Should we put up with this scorn for women, or will authorities finally make laws against these debilitating practices? Without them, hands will remain tied and raised. We turn now to our column, The Last Word. The title this week, Free to Live in a Delusionary World. When loved ones refuse treatment for mental illness, said Stephanie McCrummon, families have few options. Everyone is worried about the man in the house. His ex-wife, his mother, his father, his neighbors, the psychiatrist he has seen and no longer sees. They are all concerned because he has been alone in the house in suburban Maryland for 2 years. No one knows what he is doing. No one knows what he is thinking, what he is eating, or how he is surviving. In 2 years, since his frightened wife took their three young boys and left him there alone, he has not spoken to anyone for more than a few minutes. He has not let anyone beyond the front door, which he has fortified with a new lock, a piece of plastic bolted over the window, and a piece of plywood bolted below that, all of which he has painted an almost fluorescent shade of yellow. He keeps the living room curtains shut. The man in the house, a 42-year-old who once earned six figures working on Capitol Hill, was a devoted husband and father, tells his family that he is not sick. As far as they know, he has stopped taking the psychiatric medication prescribed after he told police that God was speaking through his three-year-old son. He has quit his job and stopped paying bills. His family doesn't know what to do. His mother leaves bags of groceries on the porch. His ex-wife sends text messages, and his responses are increasingly worrying, such as when he refers to his sons as his, quote, S-U-N-S, sons. His father is always leaving a version of the same phone message. Hey, this is Dad. Let me know if you want to come out and talk. We love you. We care about you. Which his son never answers. Once, this man's family might have handled the situation by having him involuntarily committed to a psychiatric institution. For decades, it was routine and simple procedure. If a doctor agreed that a patient had a mental illness, he could be institutionalized even against his will. The problem was that it was a process with few safeguards, and during much of the 20th century, all kinds of people who didn't belong, from free-thinking women to gay people, minorities and rebellious children, wound up locked in hospitals where abuse was common and conditions were often bleak. So the system changed, with one catalyst being a 1975 Supreme Court ruling that effectively restricted involuntary commitment to instances when a person becomes a danger to self or others, a phrase that now appears as in one form or another in state laws across the country. But 40 years after that standard was established, some people are asking whether society's concern for the constitutional rights of people with mental illness has led to their abandonment. At a moment when about one quarter of the homeless population suffers from severe mental illness, when the number of mentally ill prison inmates is higher than ever, and when mass shootings are often followed by stories that the shooter had heard voices, the people asking questions include the family of the man in the house. Their concern is growing every day. Because he does not think he is sick, voluntary treatment is not an option. Unless he threatens to harm himself or someone else, or is so sick he cannot keep himself alive, he cannot be deemed dangerous, particularly in Maryland, where commitment laws are among the most stringent in the nation. And though there are days when he wears bright yellow from head to toe, or all white, including sandals he sprayed with white paint, he appears well-groomed and healthy at this point, so he is unlikely to meet even the most lenient legal definition of dangerous. On day 730 of being alone in the house, he still tends the lawn. The few times he has opened the bright yellow door to get groceries or money from his worried mother, what she could see of the living room appeared clean, if bare, the family photos removed from the walls. The ex-wife of the man in the house, who for privacy reasons is being identified only by her first name, Jennifer, wishes that her ex-husband, whom she still loves, could be involuntarily committed to a psychiatric hospital for however long it takes doctors to figure out what's wrong, for medications to work, and for him to once again be the person she married. But because she can't have him committed, she is doing the only thing she can think of to do. In accordance with the divorce decree, she is selling the house, which she is hoping will force her ex-husband into a situation desperate enough that he might meet the standard for involuntary commitment. For him to get better, she realizes, she and his family have to let him get worse. He'll become homeless, she says, and we just have to let it happen. She has been watching him deteriorate for 3 years now, a process she traces to the night he didn't want to share a glass of wine, which had been their evening ritual since they bought the house and started building their life together. He wanted to be on the computer instead. He began reading conspiracy theory websites. He started saying he was going to jail and taking batteries out of cell phones. Jennifer told herself it was stress and tried to get him to see a counselor, but he wouldn't. Then one day a package arrived and he told her to take the kids outside, and she watched as he put on a biohazard mask and used long arm tools to open the box, which contained a crank radio he ordered. He built an 8-foot-high cross and nailed it to a tree in the front yard. He started wearing all yellow or all white. When they visited a relative who had a gun with 5 bullets mounted on the wall, he said the bullets were a sign their family of 5 was going to be killed. Jennifer kept trying to persuade him to see a counselor, but there was nothing else she could do to get him treatment until the day he disappeared with the boys. On that day, Jennifer called the police, who tracked him to Atlanta, where he reportedly told them that he and his children were going to be killed and that a flock of birds had signaled for him to take the boys south. She and her father-in-law arranged for a mobile crisis team, mental health workers and police trained for such situations, to meet them back in Maryland. And when he still refused to see a doctor, police were able to invoke the danger to self or others standard because of the erratic trip, his delusions about being killed, and a small knife found in his possession. It was the one time he met the threshold of involuntary commitment. He was taken to the emergency room in handcuffs, at which point an array of regulations aimed at protecting his civil liberties kicked in. Within 6 hours, a doctor had to certify that he was dangerous. Within 30 hours, the ER had to locate a bed in a psychiatric hospital or release him. Once he was admitted, he was appointed an attorney and a hearing was scheduled before a judge who would review whether he was still dangerous enough to stay hospitalized. And even then, he still had to consent to taking medication. After a while, doctors felt he was improving. He admitted to making errors in judgment, according to his medical records, and agreed that his thoughts about the family being killed were not based in reality. After 24 days, doctors found that he was no longer suicidal or homicidal. He no longer met the criteria for involuntary commitment, and so he was discharged. Back home, he went off his medication. He became angry and withdrawn, cursing his wife and family for putting him in the hospital. Then he sent Jennifer an email referring to her in the third person. Quote, "She's hell-bent on lying," it began, which a counselor told her exhibited the kind of dissociative thinking that precedes a potentially violent psychotic break. And she left. He followed her. He banged on her parents' door in the middle of the night. She called the police, who saw that he was violating a protective order she had obtained, and took him to jail, which, as Jennifer now sees, it was his last chance for help. She said that during his court appearance, she begged the judge to order mental health treatment, but a psychiatric evaluation found that he was only delusional, not dangerous, which limited what the judge could do. He was released after 4 days. He went back to the house and painted the door yellow. On day 889, word comes that the man has disappeared again. Jennifer is standing at the yellow door. Her hands are shaking. She has her old keys, and she is trying to get inside the house for the first time since she left. She had monitored his Skype call with the boys a few days earlier. He appeared to be in some kind of shed. Jennifer slips through a window and lands in the laundry room, and for the first time in more than 2 years, she is inside of the house. She turns on the light. "Wow," she says. The washer and dryer are sprayed with a streak of yellow. The labels on two bottles of Sun soap are covered with yellow duct tape. She walks upstairs and into the foyer. "Please remove footwear," she says, reading a handwritten sign taped to the wall, and turns into the living room where the stuff of their old life is heaped in piles. My God. There is their leather couch turned over. There is their chair, all the cushions pulled off. By the fireplace is a crate of wire and circuit boards, a half-disassembled power washer, and the boys' disassembled bunk beds. She goes back downstairs, down into the basement den where they used to share their glass of wine. She opens a cabinet that is empty except for two things. "Huh," she says, taking out a Coke bottle that she had kept for sentimental reasons and a sherry carafe that was a favorite wedding present. "See," she says, "he knows these are two things that would mean anything to me. He's not mean." The next morning, she comes back with a truck to pack up what she wants to salvage. On day 896, the house with the yellow door is empty. The man who was there stops communicating with his family, except for text messages he sends to his ex-wife to arrange calls with his sons, which are becoming less frequent. The family who loves him, who would do anything for him, stops trying to persuade him to get help. They wish he could be involuntarily committed. He can't be involuntarily committed. The man in the house is now out of the house and somewhere else on his own. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. Take a look now at a couple of health and science shorts. The first, deadly virus found in storage closet. Workers at the National Institutes of Health recently made an alarming discovery while cleaning out an old storage room at a government building in Bethesda, Maryland. 6 vials of smallpox. The samples were quickly transported to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's High Security Containment Unit in Atlanta, one of only 2 locations where the deadly virus is known to be stored. The CDC said that none of the vials had been breached and that no employees were exposed. The FBI is investigating how the samples, which date to 1954, wound up in the old lab. One of the deadliest diseases known to humanity, smallpox killed up to 500 million people in the 20th century alone. The last known case in the U.S. occurred in 1949, and worldwide vaccination programs eradicated the disease in 1980. Live samples are kept at the CDC facility in Atlanta and a similar facility in Novosibirsk, Russia, in order to make vaccines in the event of a future outbreak. The freezers of the microbiology labs of the world are a lot like the trunks in your attic, infectious disease expert Michael Osterholm tells USA Today. When you open them up, sometimes you are surprised. The trials of going solo. People simply don't like being alone with their thoughts. That's the conclusion of a new research that examined how well humans cope without external stimuli. In a series of experiments, participants who ranged in age from 18 to 77 were asked to sit in an empty room for 6 to 15 minutes. When quizzed on the experience afterward, roughly half of the subjects reported that they didn't enjoy it. To gauge just how unpleasant it really was, researchers administered positive stimuli in the form of pleasant photographs and negative stimuli via electric shocks. Subjects were then asked if they would be willing to pay to experience or avoid the stimulation again. Remarkably, 67% of the men and 25% of the women who had said they would pay to avoid another shock wound up zapping themselves during the subsequent thinking period of the experiment. Researchers said the surprising findings support the theory that mammals evolved to closely monitor their environments for opportunities or dangers, making sustained internal focus seem unnatural. We had this big brain full of pleasant memories and were able to tell ourselves stories and make up fantasies, University of Virginia psychologist Timothy Wilson tells the Washington Post. But despite that, we keep finding that people don't like it much. Turning now to the talking points. The first one, Obamacare. The winners and losers so far. Obamacare haters, your case just got weaker, said Jonathan Cohn in NewRepublic.com. A Commonwealth Fund study revealed last week that about 9.5 million fewer adults are uninsured than when open enrollment in the Affordable Care Act's exchanges began last fall. Many of these adults had purchased subsidized insurance under Obamacare or enrolled in the newly expanded Medicaid program. Even better, they are satisfied customers, regardless of their politics. Even 74% of Republicans are happy with their new coverage. The ACA has faced nonstop predictions of disaster from the conservatives, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times, none of which have come true. Enrollment has surged past White House targets, and most people have bought policies on the exchanges at low or reasonable cost. The usual suspects will keep crying failure, but the truth is that health reform is, gasp, working. Obamacare supporters are playing fast and loose with the numbers, said Chris Conover in Forbes.com. The Commonwealth survey has a hefty margin of error, so the uninsured rate could have fallen by only 5.5 million, not 9.5 million. Meanwhile, insurers are about to drop an Obamacare bomb, said Philip Klein in WashingtonExaminer.com. A PricewaterhouseCoopers survey of 18 states found that the cost of policies could increase by an average of more than 7% next year. These costs will be shouldered by the middle-class families who don't qualify for the ACA subsidies, and younger and healthier patients forced to accept comprehensive coverage they don't need and can't afford. Yes, Obamacare has left some better off, but there are many losers under the law, too. Still, the catastrophe conservatives predicted hasn't occurred, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. Indeed, many more insurance companies are joining the exchanges in 2015, and the ACA will only improve as competition increases and the bugs are worked out. But is that really a defeat for conservatism? No. The ACA was based on some pretty conservative ideas, including expanding health coverage through market-oriented exchanges of private insurers. Indeed, if Obamacare succeeds, it would kill the liberal dream of a national single-payer system. Years after President Obama has left office, Republicans are going to look back on his signature health care policy and find quite a bit to like. Another Talking Point article about Obama. Obama, the GOP's dream of impeachment. Too many Republicans are being seduced by the fantasy of impeaching Barack Obama, said Wesley Prudent in the Washington Times. Former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin has added her voice to a growing chorus, declaring last week that the president has caused irreparable harm to America. The many impeachable offenses of President Obama can no longer be ignored, she said. Other conservatives clamoring for impeachment include talk radio personalities and Fox News pundits, as well as respectable Republican office holders such as Senators James Inhofe and Tom Coburn. It's a popular message among Republican voters, said Emily Swanson in HuffingtonPost.com. In a new YouGov poll, 68% of Republicans said Congress would be justified in starting impeachment proceedings against Obama, up from 50% last year. The impeachment crowd is firing at the wrong target at the wrong time with the wrong ammunition, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. While Obama has been a lousy president, the Constitution states that the president can be impeached only for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Obama hasn't lied under oath like Bill Clinton or obstructed justice like Richard Nixon. If Republicans push forward, they'll play directly into progressive hands, rallying demoralized Democratic voters who would otherwise have stayed home from this November's midterms. Republicans should remember what happened last time they tried to indict a president they viewed with contempt, said Carl Cannon in RealClearPolitics.com. In 1998, they failed to secure a conviction in the Senate, subsequently lost control of the House, and watched in horror as Clinton became the most popular man in the world. So go ahead and indict Obama. That'll show them. Some Republicans are now desperately trying to cool impeachment fever, said Jonathan Capehart in WashingtonPost.com. House Speaker John Boehner has announced plans to sue Obama over his alleged abuse of executive authority, hoping to direct his party's fury at the president into a harmless lawsuit. But Palin and other Tea Partiers have already dismissed Boehner's move as a legal stunt. And should Republicans seize control of the Senate this fall, the pressure to bring Obama to heel will be unrelenting. At that point, Republican leaders may have no choice but to follow the party's wingnuts off the impeachment cliff. And a third talking point article, Chicago. Would gun laws stop the carnage? Chicago has just witnessed a tiny mayhem worthy of urban war zones worldwide, said the Chicago Tribune in an editorial. In an 84-hour period over the 4th of July weekend, 82 people were struck by gunfire, 14 of them fatally. The mayhem was so thick that police responding to shootings kept interrupting each other on their radios with reports of newly erupting gun battles elsewhere in the city's blighted neighborhoods. We can only hope that the bloody numbers help in tipping the balance toward eventual enactment of common-sense gun laws, said the Washington Post. Guns are so easy to get in the city streets that a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old died in gun battles with cops. The consequences of Congress's abdication on gun control are playing out on the streets of Chicago and other cities across the nation. There's just one flaw in that argument, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Chicago has some of the strictest gun laws in the country. The city, in fact, is a running illustration of the cliché that if you ban guns, only criminals will own them. The real problem is the profound social breakdown of certain neighborhoods, where lawlessness is the norm and life is all too cheap. To respond to Chicago's carnage by demanding more gun control laws is lazy and irresponsible, said S.E. Cupp in NYDailyNews.com. Only law-abiding gun owners will submit to background checks, gun registries, magazine restrictions, and other legislation. If gun control advocates were less interested in scoring meaningless political points, they'd clamor instead for inner-city programs designed to pull young men out of gangs and into jobs. We've already tried that, said Charles Lipson in ChicagoTribune.com. Over the past 50 years, we have poured trillions of dollars into well-intentioned poverty programs of every imaginable kind. These programs failed and often made the problems worse by rewarding single parenthood, weakening families and private institutions, and creating a corrosive culture of dependency. Maybe it's time we stop trying to micromanage the lives of the poor and instead limit government handouts to temporary cash grants to the truly needy. More money from Washington isn't going to end inner-city chaos. The body count should be proof enough. And a few notes here. Asia is now the biggest source of immigrants to the U.S., providing 45% of all new immigrants in 2012. compared with 34% for Latin America. Mexico accounts for 14% of all new immigrants, down from 45% in 2000. India now accounts for 12%, and China for 10%. Private investigators have begun using drones to spy on adulterous spouses, parents caught up in custody disputes, and people suspected of filing false disability claims. The drones are a game changer, said Long Island, New York private investigator Matthew Cipher. In more than 50% of mass murders in the U.S. since 2006, the shooters target spouses, ex-spouses, and other relatives. About 620 million Indians, or 50% of that country's population, have no access to a working toilet or latrine and thus defecate outside in the street or countryside. The resulting bacterial infections lead to widespread malnutrition among children and cause 62 million Indians under 5 to suffer permanent physical and mental stunting. On our poll watch, in the aftermath of the Edward Snowden leaks, 81% of people surveyed in 36 countries opposed the U.S.'s surveillance of citizens abroad, and 73% opposed the spying on foreign leaders. U.S. drone strikes targeting terrorists are also unpopular, with majorities or pluralities opposing them in 39 of 44 countries surveyed. And we'll wind up with a quote from science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke. How inappropriate to call this planet Earth when it is quite clearly ocean. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.